The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Bonjour, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a tireless opponent of trans fats, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
Hey, Mike. Man, I hate them trans fats.
I know, they are the enemy. So, speaking of the enemy, the president has released the National Intelligence Estimate, and the news is not good. Project Runway has become a cause célèbre for jihadists. You watch Project Runway, Rick?
No, man, because it interferes with Jericho and the Nine. And that, and between that and the briefcase show, yes. I try to spend a lot of time watching people guess what's in a briefcase.
I have to admit, I kind of like the briefcase show.
But, you know, I mean, they could actually do that with cross training for, say, the Iraqi police and militia, right?
Yeah.
They got to spend a lot of time guessing, is that a bomb? Is it not a bomb? They could use that deal or no deal. It's kind of a training exercise.
Uh-huh. But then in that case, the women would be in burqas, and that wouldn't be as much fun.
Well, and I mean, how cool would it be if like one out of every 26 cases was actually a conventional explosive?
Actually, not good at all. But if you have any bad ideas like Rick does, send us a letter at letters@edexcellence.net. It is okay. Let's get going, Rick.
Double the ratings if there was a chance the model was going to blow up.
Well, unfortunately, you're probably right.
That's what I'm
talking Rick,
about.
We have some special folks on the show today.
Outstanding.
You know, our good friend Liam is not able to be here with us.
I hear he's off drinking midday?
We don't want to spread the rumors.
But, okay.
But
Liam,
our,
it's safe with me, baby.
That's right. But our producer, Jen, is going to help us with Pardon the Gadfly. And our research intern, Kobe, is here with a dose of education news of the weird.
Now, is that Kobe as in Kobe tuna or Kobe beef?
Exactly.
Okay. That's not tuna, right?
It's not tuna, no.
It's beef.
Are you thinking salmon? What's the salmon? Coho salmon? Yeah, Kobe beef. You're right.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, and the basketball player, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Named after the beef.
Very good. All right, well.
Do you know who the basketball player's dad was?
I don't. Who is
it? Jellybean Bryant.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Pro athlete in his own right.
Okay, right. Back to education. Jen, why don't you tee us up for a game of Pardon the Gadfly?
Okay, guys. Topic one. This week's Education Gadfly, Liam Julian wonders if the prevalence of niche marketing, selling less of more, as described in the best-selling book The Long Tail, gives more credence to those advocating for core curriculum in K-12 schools. Specifically, he posits that without a basic core of knowledge, information will grow ever more segmented and that gradually our society will lose touch with its common features and retreat into myriad niche... How do you say that? I've heard it both ways.
Niches.
Niches. All right. Liam says
Nietzsche?
Niches.
Yes.
All right. Mike, do we need a core curriculum to battle the fragmentation of social interaction and learning, or is Liam just trying to sound smart again?
Well, Liam does always try to sound smart. He always puts those tricky words into the script like Nietzsche. Yes. But you know, it's a pretty good piece, though. I do recommend that our listeners read it. You know,
seeing as how you publish it, there's a shock.
Yeah, I guess so. Look, but here's his argument. You know, you look at a firm like Netflix, right? They do most of their business through these tiny little movies, documentaries that people have never heard of. But since they have this vast database, people order it, and that's what people watch. Whereas Blockbuster, which is brick and mortar, really makes all of its money off of the hits. The point is the internet allows us to have more of these niches, allows people to get to specific information. Some people would say, well, then, you know, why do we need students, children anymore, to learn about a broad swath of knowledge? Why is that, Rick?
I mean, right, and this is the Don Hirsch argument that you need common touchstones and people need to have common references in order to be able to talk back and forth in order to argue about historic development or what have you. But, I mean, frankly, you know, Liam's argument could just as easily be spun the other way. In a time when you've got more knowledge in any given area of endeavor, you actually need to know more about it in order to really master it and make a contribution. One could argue that it's okay if, particularly, say, at the high school level, after some fundamental basis, if people are pursuing different strands of knowledge.
All right. So that's the fundamental debate then, is at what level is it okay for students of any kind to start developing specialized knowledge? Some people would say that's at the high school level. Others would say at the college level. Others say we should wait until graduate school and even the
and others would say you can go ahead and do it earlier.
That's right. Yeah.
But Liam does make it sound like we're all going to turn in like those Morlocks from the time machine. We're going to fragment and go underground and lose touch with each other.
But see, because, you know, I don't even get that reference. We're already losing touch with one another.
Exactly. So why don't we just embrace it?
Yeah. Okay. Jen, what's up?
All right. Topic two, Rick. Looks like Alberta, the Canadian backwater, is at the fore of international education. The Economist recently reported that, were Alberta its own country, it would rank among the top four nations worldwide in math, reading, and science. Is it a coincidence that this province has a strong set of standards and tests and that its capital city, Edmonton, was the first city to experiment with weighted student funding?
I don't think so.
Is it a coincidence, Rick, or might we be able to learn something from these folks?
Wow. This is shilling for the whole product line of the Fordham Foundation. I like it. Is Alberta really the Canadian backwater? That's harsh. Look, I mean, it depends. You know, if you break stuff down enough, I'm sure Westchester, you know, New York, or Bergen County, New Jersey, if they were their own countries, I'm sure they'd score a lot better off too. So you can always slice and dice these things to prove a point. The fact that Alberta has, you know, weighted student funding is part of a reform effort in Alberta, which is focused on giving folks at schools more flexibility, more ability to make decisions based on the quality of personnel, more ability to select programs. Sure, that's, you know, that's absolutely something worth looking at and talking about. The fact that, you know, that they do weighted student funding in itself shouldn't be taken as, you know, evidentiary proof in any particular direction.
Such the cynic, Rick. Well, what I found interesting was that the article was about Alberta, not just Edmonton. We've all heard a lot about it, Edmonton, the last few years, but that Alberta itself is doing quite well, and that it has very rigorous standards, a good core curriculum, assessments, accountability. I mean, the whole, you know, all the key ingredients that we think probably help improve schools. So I say we all take a field trip up there to the Great White North and check it out.
I think that sounds pretty good.
All righty. Jen, what's the last one?
All right, the final topic. New York Times Magazine recently featured a front page article about a young man, Michael Oher, who was plucked from Memphis's streets and shoddy schools, where he was discounted and ignored, of course, given extra attention in the classroom and who now plays left tackle for Ole Miss. It's an inspiring story about how obstacles can be overcome, but it's worth wondering, do all inner city kids have to be 6'5", 350 pounds in order for us to close the achievement gap?
Whew, let's hope not, huh? I don't know, Rick, if you saw this article, but I tell you, it was a fantastic piece. You know, I got a little teary-eyed, I'll admit, and not just because it's this inspirational story, you know, of a kid who could have been lost to the streets and all of that, but just by the, you know, by the sheer randomness of it. I mean, this guy they described as a freak of nature because I guess he has all the physical attributes you need to be a great left tackle, which, by the way, turns out, I guess, is the most valued position in all
You're
of football.
Protecting the quarterback's blind side, baby.
There it is. There it is. And so this guy
if he's a right-handed quarterback. He's a left-handed quarterback. It's the right tackle.
Right, 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 right. And you know, and yet that was such a fluke. But here's another point about this article, right? So this left tackle, right tackle thing. Did you know that left tackles get paid three times as much as right tackles in the NFL?
I did not know that. I did not know that. Now, do we actually know anything about the grades he got after he was discovered for his physical gifts?
When he first showed up at the private school, he failed all of his classes. He just couldn't function. He didn't know any. But then he was able to get this whole support system around. He had a tutor. They worked really hard. And by the end, he was getting his grades up to A's and B's.
What's his GPA at Ole Miss?
I do not know his GPA at Ole Miss. That's a good question. But back to my point about left tackles and right tackles, Rick, because this is a really good one. So they pay positions more based on you know, how valuable it is to the team, right? Isn't this like why we should pay math and science teachers more than, say, art and music teachers? I mean, not because they're intrinsically more valuable, but because they just happen to bring more.
You sold me, baby. Although, you know what my takeaway is here? This really reminds me of Trading Places, Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. If you remember, when Randolph and Mortimer Duke, identify Eddie Murphy when he's stealing the fish from the Christmas party.
Yeah.
And then they have and then they say they bet a buck that they could turn him into an aspiring, effective young broker, and Aykroyd will become a thief if they steal, and he goes off and hooks up with Jamie Lee Curtis, who plays a hooker.
Okay. Right, but, right.
I mean, the thing here is it's a vision of the malleability. It's a vision, right? It's really a No Child Left Behind story about the malleability of human achievement, that people are not that people's futures have not been written, but that we can equip them to succeed. So I think
lovely.
It's a touching and motivational piece.
It's nurture, not nature. I like that.
Boom.
Okay, Rick. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Jen, thank you very much for teeing it up so nicely for us.
Beautifully done.
Now we turn to this week's interview, which is about reading first. Let's take a listen. We're here today with Jim Herman, who is the Reading First Director for the state of Tennessee. Jim, thanks for joining us on the show.
You're welcome.
So, Jim, our listeners that may have read the Inspector General report about Reading First or maybe seen some of the press accounts over the last week, you know, probably have this impression that this program was mismanaged and that the directors of the program were twisting people's arms. What's your take on all of this? You've been working on this program now, I assume, for several years there in Tennessee. Is that the impression of Reading First that you have?
I think that Reading First is one of the very best programs we've ever had. It's changed teacher practice. It's shown great results in student achievement. And it's just been overall a great program.
So, and has that been necessarily your experience with most federal programs, or is there something about Reading First that makes it different?
Reading First was probably the highest monitored program that we've had, and it looked closely at all aspects continuously. We did professional development, we did classroom observations, we did school monitoring, district monitoring. We had a lot of buy-in from teachers and principals and district leaders, and
right.
It's just really been top-notch.
Now, Jim, you know, people, this report certainly makes it sound like the department, the federal Department of Education, was heavy-handed and was pushing states to adopt programs they didn't want to adopt. I mean, again, what was your experience around all of that, around the leadership at the Department of Education?
I think the leadership from the Department of Education was great. They worked closely with us. Their main goal was to get students reading better, to increase student achievement, and overall, I think it's just been a great program.
Okay. Jim, have you had a chance to talk to other Reading First directors since this report came out? I'm just curious what folks are saying out there in the field.
Yes, and of course I haven't talked to all Reading First directors, but the ones that I've talked to, we all agree that Reading First has just been a super program, and that it's just done a lot to change practice, and that's a good thing.
All right. Well, I really appreciate it, Jim. You know, I understand that when the Reading First directors all get together, there's always a lot of misty eyes because everybody feels so good about what you're doing to help children learn how to read. And it's just a shame that's, of course, not the impression that the public's gotten over the last week. So, Jim,
I think we're all proud to be Reading First directors.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, Jim, thanks for coming on the show, and keep up the great work out there in Tennessee.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Rick, I have to say, this whole Reading First thing has me really torn up. You know, I have a piece in the Gadfly this week that explains that the director of Reading First, Chris Doherty, is really getting thrown under the bus by Margaret Spellings. You know, he is doing exactly what the president expected him to do, but also what Congress expected, which was to make sure that only rigorous, scientifically based reading programs got funded under this program. That was a different approach than the feds have ever taken, and that meant doing business differently at the Department of Education. Just the whole thing just makes me sick.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the deeper reflection here is that when you have to stack committees to this extent, I mean, people stack the Federal Reserve, right? You find the kinds of economists that you're comfortable with, but we all kind of agree that they're playing by the same set of rules, and there's an understanding of what constitutes reliable and valid data for Federal Reserve deliberations. Problem here is we haven't established that, and because they have worked so hard and aggressively to bend the framework and the process in a way that delivers the results that the administration was hoping for, problem is now going to be trying to disentangle this and convince everybody going forward that this process is going to actually be credible.
But Rick, I mean, so the Federal Reserve analogy is right, but this is an area where we've got 30 years of good research.
Then you shouldn't have to stack the process this way.
Showing what works. Unfortunately, the field is full of people who are still have this religious belief in whole language. So yes, they did not put whole language people on the review panels. Of course they didn't. The law basically said it is illegal to fund whole language programs under this act. So I don't see what's wrong with that. Again, the whole thing is just a sorted affair.
I think we've had about 4 or 5 years of questions raised about the way in which the approval processes were working. Partly the fact is that there's very little research on these programs that are getting approved that constitutes what most of us would consider reliable and valid research in the traditional sense. So there's a lot of judgment calls being made. And if you got judgment calls being made and you want the program to be seen as stable and as credible, then you got to make sure that you have a broad-based agreement about what's going in. If you don't have that, there's real problems with trying to run a process like this.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if they had run any different kind of process, we'd have a whole lot of whole language programs getting funded, and and we want to see kids learning how to read. But let's talk about something happier, a little bit more fun. Kobe is here with Education News of the Weird, everyone's favorite. Although, you know, Kobe doesn't look very happy. He kind of has this, I don't know, this kind of look of disgust on his face. What's with all the stack of museum pamphlets?
I'm shocked, Mike. Shocked at the outrageous pornography that populates our dear city. At the National Gallery of Art, a short metro ride away, Parau Nate Varua Ino, a painting by that 19th century Larry Flint, Paul Gauguin, hangs unabashedly, a Tahitian woman staring at passersby, completely nude. And there's more. The Phillips, the Renwick, the Hirshhorn, all brimming with indecency.
For our listeners, I just want to know, Rick has now gotten up and is now running out the door.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't know. So there's a lot of people walking past these pieces who are completely nude?
Rick,
oh, the piece, listen better. The pieces, I'm confused. Okay.
Kobe, go ahead. Sorry.
Look, that's at the museums here, but I know the Frisco Independent School District would be just as shocked as I am. Recently, they placed 28-year veteran teacher Sydney McGee on administrative leave after she allowed her fifth grade class, while on a museum field trip, to gaze upon a nude sculpture. a parent complained and McGee was out of the classroom, lickety-split. Rick, can you imagine that? Nudity at a museum?
Man, well, you don't want your teachers taking people to these kinds of irresponsible, kind of off-the-path hellholes. You never know. You know, if you take them to a ball game, you know everybody's going to stay dressed and clothed. That's the problem with trying to get all this art stuff in education.
You know, but where's this going to lead, Rick? I mean, next, teachers are going to be afraid to take their students to the zoo in case they go to the monkey exhibit, if you know what I mean. I mean, you know.
Or the turtles. Sometimes turtles get after it. I saw that one. San Diego Zoo, man. 150-pound sea turtles. Bam!
Oh, wow. That is a disgusting lesson on so many levels.
Well, I got to say, I was so bored every time we had a field trip to museum and art places when I was a kid. But I think you're right, Mike. This has got to stop.
This has got to stop.
It's gone too far.
It has gone too far. Well, we have gone too far. We are over our time limit. So that is all the time that we do have. I hope that you will join us next week. Until then, read the original Education Gadfly for all your news and views in education at www.edexcellence.net. Till then.
I'm Rick Hess. I believe reading comes first.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, and I'm shocked and appalled at the graphic art. Kobe, Jen, thanks for joining us today. Till then, I'm signing off from the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation.